I would say I was highly capable. And that's not particularly sexy, is it?
But the word capable.
Yeah.
No, somebody once told me I was pragmatic and I was really pissed off.
7 young boys attacked me and my boyfriend at the time. I ended up quite black and blue, bruised, split lips, etc. And just realised how vulnerable I was and didn't want to find myself in that situation again. It was fantastic, and we still laugh about it now, the blisters, the loss of toenails. I'm sorry, Caitlin. but it was that mantra of, what if we can't do it? Well, what if we can? And if we don't, does it matter? Like, but we'll learn something from it.
Welcome to Series 2 of the Dangerous Women podcast, hosted by me, Sophie Norris. Our podcast claims the dangerous woman mantle, one incredible, dangerous businesswoman at a time. The Dangerous Women Collective is a community of professional women where we celebrate our achievements, support our successes, and champion our contributions to the world of work. On the Dangerous Women Collective podcast, we host in-depth conversations with the brilliant women in our network. And in this series, that includes women from actresses to CMOs, combat helicopter pilots to DE&I trailblazers. Listen to their tales of daring do and hear firsthand the power of zig over zag. We dare you to listen. It gives me great pleasure to introduce you to Julie Beriff today. Julie, or Jules, is the UK Marketing Director for ESET, one of the world's largest cybersecurity providers. Cyber attacks sit on the national security front line, the top of every government's agenda, so I think it's pretty safe to say that Jules represents one of the most dangerous industries around today. But Jules herself is pretty badass, sharing so many of the characteristics we come to expect from our cohort of dangerous women. She runs towards fresh opportunities presented her. She is resilient, unafraid of challenge, fun, ovs, and was once UK kickboxing champion for a year. Oh my God, we are totally talking about that. Her career has been varied and interesting, just as you would expect. She started working at Newcastle Uni on international projects while studying for her MA. She then segued into promoting film for the North East before being seconded to BAFTA to represent the same region. Seduced by a job title, she then hopped into the old Business Link service, headed up marketing, and then was made redundant. After a soulless year in the Middle East, the job, not the place, she danced back into the cultural sector at the Science Museum Group, moved to English Heritage as territory manager for the north of England, where she spent 6 happy years before moving to the Continuum Group in 2016 as head of sales, marketing and brand experience. God, I'm dizzy out of breath, and we haven't even covered her move to ESET yet, and the complex and continually moving world of cybersecurity. So why don't we let Jules pick up here and find out a bit more about the jump from history and heritage into sci-fi and tech. So thank you so much for being here today, Jules. It's great to see you.
Delighted.
It's been a little while, so let's not use the podcast for catching up. We can do that later. So yeah, I kind of headlined you. I know I've missed out loads of stuff, but I've always known you in cybersecurity and ESET. So could you just tell a little bit about that, your career and your transition into ESET and what made you make that move? Because it's a biggie.
It was a biggie and daunting and terrifying and scary all at the same time.
Yeah.
The previous part of my career, I'd done some quite long stints in various organisations. Whilst I wasn't ready for a move into tech and cyber, it wasn't even on my radar. The opportunity presented itself. And I thought, why not? Why not? And I was ready for a challenge. I was ready for something new. I was ready to step up. I was ready to leap forward into something that was really going to push me out of my comfort zone, allow me to grow. So that was the move. And it was as scary as I had anticipated.
I mean, you didn't just change industries. And BT Dubs, being fearless is definitely a trope of dangerous women. So, you know, bravo for, I guess, taking a leap of faith in a lot of ways. But also, and we touched on this when we chatted the other day, your job is not close to where you live.
No.
So you're also doing that hybrid.
Very much so.
Which I guess the world allows us to do. But talk a bit of how does that, because you've got pets, animals, husbands, stepchildren, the works, and yet your job is what, 200-300 miles away?
300 miles south, yeah. So I am a happy wife with 2 wonderful stepchildren, 2 miniature dachshunds, living in deepest, darkest, rural North Yorkshire. And our UK office is probably as far south as we could go.
I mean, Isle of Wight, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. So sunny Bournemouth on the south coast. So it's a 600-mile round trip to the office.
Gosh.
every other week, Monday morning, either on the train or in the car, head down to Bournemouth and then come back kind of Wednesday, Thursday. It could be one of those things that really pisses you off and that grates on you. But I've made my peace with it. And I've made my peace with it in the fact that it's 10 hours done in two chunks of five, as opposed to, in my previous role, 10 hours done at 2 hours every day. Yeah. So I just had to think, I had to change my mindset on what it was. And actually, it allows me some thinking time. If I'm on the train, I can work. If I'm in the car, I tend to listen to podcasts and use my brain. I think a lot. So it's not, made my peace. Same amount of time in the week, just in a different way. And time well spent on listening, thinking that I wouldn't ordinarily get.
Yeah, so I too am one of these people. So I have been, I live in Devon and my job has been in London for the last 31 years. I've been commuting like that for 20 of them. Mm-hmm. So like I'm the OG hybrid worker, I think. But I couldn't agree. It's about reframing your mindset and not begrudging the journey, but embracing it.
Correct.
And also that it enables you to live the life you want. Like how lucky are we to live in Yorkshire or Devon, with the people that we love, doing a job that we love. And, you know, if a bit of travel is the sacrifice you have to make, then fine. And I'm like you, I sometimes use my train journeys to just catch up on life stuff.
Admin.
As well. Well, admin or memes I haven't seen.
Yeah.
You know, just that stuff that fills your brain as well. Exactly like you said, thinking time, but real tangential thinking time, which we never, particularly as women, very rarely gives ourselves because we're walking dogs, feeding children, feeding husbands, doing the shopping. And you can't do it when you're stuck on a plane, train. Or a plane. I love it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you told me, again, I just want to touch about one of your superpowers, that you, in several of your jobs, you've kind of walked in to a...
Chaos.
Okay. I'm going to allow you to say it. Chaos. And again, I suspect that's quite a dangerous-y women kind of thing. Like, let's not walk into something easy. Let's go into something hard and make it our own. Talk to me a little bit about why that appeals to you.
I have no interest of picking up where somebody's left off, I suppose. I want to go, or I have always been attracted by roles that afford me the opportunity to do it my way.
Yeah.
And I'm a fixer, I'm by nature a problem solver. I love finding a creative solution to any problem, whether it be a marketing issue, whether it be a home decor issue. Currently ripping our stairs to bits at the moment. And I just, I like to create order from chaos, I think is probably what drives me the most. And whenever I've been kind of interviewing for jobs, when there's been that notion of, you know, it's a bit broken, the people aren't happy, I'm like, bring that to me. Like, that is really attractive. When I joined English Heritage, again, the marketing department was just in a really bad way. The people were broken and had been through the mill a bit. But also I'd found cupboards with cassettes in, with radio commercials on that, like, I hadn't seen in my career.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow,
so just
okay.
Had not cleared the decks.
No, and old-fashioned ways of doing things and, like, not contemporary thinking. And, like, I genuinely believe that happy people are hardworking people and the most dedicated people. And so to go in and be able to say, right, let's wipe the slate clean. What do we need? What do we, you know, let's look ahead in a year's time. Where do we want to be? And what does that look like? And how do we start building that is really exciting, or I find very exciting. And similarly with ESET, the team had been through a really rough time. When I arrived, there were people leaving on their way out, kind of notice periods being handed in. There were people that just left, so I had roles to fill in an organisation in a world that I didn't really understand or know. And I had the people that were left were not the happiest of individuals. But what was even more daunting at this point in time was I didn't actually know what we needed because I didn't understand the world that I was working in. So I've got vacancies I need to restructure, but I don't understand the job, I don't understand the industry, I don't understand the organisation. So it was really tough for kind of the first 3 to 6 months, I would say. And I would say it took 12 months to get us to a good place. And it's only now, 3 years down the line, that I'm really starting to feel like we've got the right people in the right place doing the right things.
So two things. One, as you walked in to that situation, kind of, I mean, knowing nothing. I mean, I know you knew something, but, you know, but kind of knowing nothing with no team around you in many ways. How did you manage that? And then tell me how rewarding, because I'm all about the long story tell and the long arc. And that's obviously, you know, you've given it time for everything to bed in. So your employer, ASET, must have been generous in allowing you some of that time as well. And how did you feel then? And I guess, how do you feel now?
Okay, so...
And how did you manage then?
How did I manage? I lent on people straight away. And the lovely thing about the organisation that I work in is that I've never been in an organisation where people have been so generous with their time and their offers of help. And whether that was from the UK business or whether it was from the global organisation that we worked within, every single person that I reached out to gave me time and patience. And there was two guys in my team. There was Steve and Alan. Steve and Alan carried me through the first 3 months.
So, Stephen.
Yeah. What do I need to know? How does this work? Where's this? How do I find this? What does this mean? I don't know what you're saying. You're speaking a foreign language to me. And they were patient and they were kind. So, yeah, I just, you know, really, I've never been frightened of asking for help. I find that there's nothing quite more seductive than being asked for help yourself, and people normally go out of their way to provide that. So not being shy about the things that I didn't know, I think was what got me through that period. Did ESET afford me the luxury of time? Yes, but caveated with they still expected output. That was ever present.
And does that drive you forward?
Very much so.
Okay, so you are a reward.
Yeah, very much so. There was very clear boundaries set, very clear objectives set. These are the things that we're looking for, hit them. I like that.
Yeah.
What I don't like is being told how to get there.
No. Okay, so explain that. Yeah.
So we're going from A to B. You are currently at A. I expect you to be at B within this period of time. Now leave me alone. And I'll get there. Please rest assured, and there'll be no doubt, no ambiguity, that we will get there. But please do not tell me the path that I need to take. I think that's one of my biggest bugbears. And that's something that's always been with me and is with me at home as well, my poor husband.
So he just has to. So what you're doing is you're building kind of trust hierarchies through everything that you do. But that doesn't always work. Because it needs two people to trust, doesn't it? You need to be trusted and you need to trust.
Yes, very much so. And I think throughout my career, I've failed lots and lots and lots of times, but never without the ability to twist and make it right and get to where we need to go.
Don't you think that's the secret of failure, is how you learn from it and move on?
Very much so.
I tell my children today, who my children are big, so they're 18 and 21, but I've told them their whole lives, it's not how you respond to the great things in your life, it's how you rise up to the challenges that defines you as a human.
Definitely.
And it's quite hard to move on if there's no friction. Friction kind of causes momentum, doesn't it? Friction doesn't even be bad. It can be good too, right? But yeah.
Very much so. Yeah. Great analogy. We took the kids skiing last year, and the 13-year-old boy throwing himself down the slopes at pace.
Hell for leather.
Fell over, you know, filthy, wet. But learned so quickly. And by the end of the week, he was really, really confident, really sufficient. Off he went. Jess, 16-year-old girl, so smart, like really, really academically very clever, but didn't want to fail, didn't want to fall over. She saw falling over as a failure. And so her progress within the week was much lesser because she didn't know what it felt like to fall down. And the fear of that fall was holding her back from being able to move more quickly in the lessons. I said, you need to fall down. You need to know what it feels like, because then you won't be frightened of it. It was that fear that was holding her back, which was it was quite poignant. It was a good analogy for life.
It is. And I wonder, boys are allowed, you know, just from the get-go to rough, tumble, fall over, get up, and it's just, oh, you're just a boy.
Yeah.
Whereas girls always have to be perfect and not make a fool of themselves. Mm. And it's just even, and I'm sure your children are, you know, told they can be anything they want to do and be anything they can be and wear combat suits. Nobody gives a toss. Mm. But at the same time, there's sort of still that societal thing that you shouldn't fall down because you don't look good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You let slip to me that you were UK kickboxing champion for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out of quite a difficult situation in your life. And it just seems to sum up that kind of problem solving, scrappy, fuck 'em attitude, which you're not, because also I know you're a joy to work with, you because I've worked with you. You're a joy to work with because I've worked with you. But there is a sort of inner steel, isn't there? And this seems to some, tell me, maybe I'm wrong. Tell me about being kickboxing supremo.
Yeah. So I got my head kicked in when I was 17. Walking home from the pub with a boyfriend.
Not by horse.
It was a horrid situation of seven young boys attacked me and my boyfriend at the time.
So sorry.
he came off a lot worse. I ended up quite black and blue, bruised, split lips, etc. And just realised how vulnerable I was, how I didn't know how to look after myself, and didn't want to find myself in that situation again. So promptly tracked down a martial arts class in the middle of Newcastle. Really amazing guy called John Aitken, who I trained under for years and years. And rocked up to class, was like, I need to learn how to look after myself. And he really took me under his wing. And you're always drawn to things that you're good at, aren't you? And I'm naturally very athletic, mm-hmm. naturally very sporty, and just loved that gym, fierce, raw environment and thrived in it. I loved the community aspect of it. I loved the tribal aspect of it. I loved being part of something. Whilst combat sports are an individual sport, you train as a team. You can't train by yourself. You need...
It was part of your gym where you train as well.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. So got very good at it, became quite competitive with it, and worked my way up to a black belt very quickly. Started teaching, which was also something that became very much part of who I am and my identity, my personality. I started teaching women's classes, which I just loved. You know, you got 13-year-old girls coming in that would train me for 5 years, and you'd see them grow and flourish and be confident and be comfortable in their own bodies and know that they could look after themselves. So, and then, you know, middle-aged women coming in because they wanted to get fit and they didn't want to go to a boys' class. They wanted to be with a load of women. They felt safe there. All of that. I just loved it, thrived off it, and poured a lot of time and effort into that, and then started, you know, obviously fighting competitively as well, and did reasonably okay on that level. And I continued to teach all the way through my career, even when I was traveling, up until I met my husband 6-7 years ago. And I still tried to keep it up, like clinging on to teaching this Tuesday night class, to a point where just the travel and commitment and everything got too much. So I gave up about 4 years ago. So yeah, out of something that was really horrific and awful situation, became a huge part of my life for a very long period of time. I think the thing I love about martial arts is the raw brute force of, you know, fighting with another human being, but the discipline and the respect that sit underneath it. And both of the gyms that I've trained in are really shit hot on that. You know, don't come in, leave your ego at the door, don't be an arsehole, treat your training partners with respect and your instructors with respect. And if you don't, you're not welcome here. And I love that.
So isn't that a lesson for life, though? Treat everybody in our lives. I know one of the things you hate is rudeness.
Yes.
And obviously being micromanaged, being trusted is really important to you. But that definitely is symbiotic with all your kickboxing, a kind of core values that come out of that. You know,
very much
listen,
so.
Be respectful.
Learn. Yeah.
Open ears.
Yeah, don't have an ego. You're not going to be the best person in the gym. You are going to get put on your ass at some point.
Yeah.
It's how you deal with that afterwards. That is the mark of who you are. So there was like the community aspect of it, the tribal aspect of it, the people side of it, the discipline and respect that went with it, and then the sheer physicality of what you could do with your body.
I think you've just nailed another one of my tropes of a dangerous woman, is challenging yourself outside work. I think all dangerous women have a hobby, is not necessarily the right word, but an activity they do outside work that pushes them constantly. And that's another one, so it's going on my list. Challenging yourself outside work. And talking of which,
yes,
do you consider yourself to be dangerous? I ask all my women.
God, this question. No, I don't think I do consider myself dangerous. But what does it mean to me? It for me, it's about the ability to hold your own. And I think I've always been fiercely independent. But being dangerous is about being well-equipped. And whether that's being well-equipped with knowledge or experience or a skill set, and knowing that you've got the tools within your arsenal to be able to deal with a situation in front of you.
Agree. We've talked quite a lot in the series about big D dangerous and little D dangerous. Mm-hmm. Big D dangerous is the kickboxing you.
Yeah.
potentially.
Yeah.
Little D Dangerous is the person who goes into a room and go, look, I've got this, give me the year to deliver the results, and then come back to me in a year. And I've, you know, it's that pushing boundaries, being unafraid to do things.
Yeah, yeah.
Running towards cybersecurity when you've been working with Heritage Railways, or when all everything in between.
Mm.
I think we've all got Little D Dangerous in us. It's just some people are prouder of it than others, I think.
And I think it's that feeling of strength as well, being physically strong and also like mentally quite resilient or capable. I would say I was highly capable.
Yes.
And that's not particularly sexy, is it?
Well, the word capable.
Yeah.
No, somebody once told me I was pragmatic and I was really pissed off. It's when I just started a business with another woman who was the quite sort of dazzly one and I was the pragmatic.
Yeah.
But then, well, obviously,
but it's
named
solid.
By a man, but it means that you fucking get things done.
Yeah, exactly.
A pragmatist
is
the person who keeps the world turning, and I learned to adopt it and love it. But in the moment, I was like, oh, screw you. It's a bit like being capable. And
capable.
And everybody, like, consistency. You cannot underestimate the power of being consistent.
Oh, my God.
It's not sexy, is it?
It's not, but it's so important.
Yeah.
And we talk about this in the team quite a lot, and I made it a mission to myself, having worked for a very inconsistent boss, that I would make it my mission to be consistent. Because I know what it feels like to be on the other end of it. Not knowing where you stand, not knowing what you're going to get, not knowing what person's going to turn up. One day they're saying this, the next day they're saying that. Cancelling meetings makes you feel like shit if you're on the other end of it. And I was like, I know the anxious feeling that gave me within the workplace. And when I walked into ESET, that was one of my things. I was like, I am going to be consistent in everything that I do, or at least try.
There's two things. Dangerous women embrace the unsexy, I think, because we're not afraid of being. But also, the more serious point of that is solid teams, dangerous women, individuals are built on solid foundations. And solid foundations are not very rarely that high point. They're kind of the result of everything that's gone before it, aren't they? And without consistency, capability, pragmatism, preparedness, all those things, you can't
have the shiny
great thing.
No.
I'm like you. I like all that. I love foundational work. It's just like so important.
Yeah. I don't mind if you're an arsehole, if you're going to be consistently an arsehole.
Yeah, no,
at least I know where it's. But please don't be an arsehole and then be lovely the day. Like, I can't. I hate not knowing where I stand.
I'm the same. It's also really, really exhausting.
Yes.
And I hate being tired. Yes. Very annoying.
Yes.
I got taught a very early age in my career. Jackie Murphy, if you're listening, this is you. Never let them know you're tired. I think it was just after I had children and sort of carried it with me every day.
Yeah.
Of course, there's moments, but, you know, just in general, try and be the upbeat person in the room because it brings everybody up with you.
Yes.
I always think that tech, probably cyber tech in particular, and we touched on this, is quite a male-dominated industry.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect there's women in marketing, but overall, you know, there's still an imbalance of women in tech. You've talked, I can't remember what you talked about, something I've listened to or we talked about it already, but, you know, that you're a big proponent of encouraging more women into STEM and tech subjects.
Yeah.
Did you find that moving to ESET and how did you manage it? I think cyber in particular, there's a malevolent edge to it, isn't there?
Definitely.
Sort of young kids in hoodies who nobody knows what they're doing, tapping out code that could destroy the world. Whether, you know, I mean, that's quite extreme, isn't it? But that's the narrative.
That is the narrative, and it's quite far removed from the reality.
Yeah.
And similarly, I think the perception around tech being male dominated is the perception. But in our organization, 50% of the leadership team are women.
I'm a whooping. That's amazing. Go ESET.
UK leadership team, 50-50 split. Brilliant. Great, great representation. And you know what? It's never even a question of who's on the leadership team. I had to sit and actually count as I was coming down because
another question.
I look around that team and I see human beings rather than males and females. But then you look across the rest of our organisation and again, we're about 50-50 split male-female. However, the tech team and our pre-sales kind of tech engineers are all guys. So whilst I think the tech industry is much more balanced than the perception. When you dig down into the individual roles and responsibilities, you do still find that the more technical roles are held predominantly by guys.
I'm with you. I see human beings, not genders. Mm. But when you're looking from the outside in on an industry, I think that it is, you do want to see faces like yours, whether that's gender, colour, sexuality, anything in those roles for you to think, okay, that's a job for me. So I'm absolutely not putting ESET on the front line of doing that. The more we can show, I think the better it is.
Yeah.
And I think all technology companies have a sort of role in changing that narrative and showing the diversity that they have in their workforce.
But it's very much at ground roots level as well.
And school, isn't it?
Yeah, well, with school and university, we sponsor a female, or we run a female scholarship or a scholarship for a female within cyber with Bournemouth University.
Amazing.
Which is great. And we've got a really great student called Lorraine going through her first year at the moment. We'll relaunch that in September this year. So we're really pushing it, but it was slim pickings to find a group of women that were going through that course. It was very much predominantly male. Yeah. So I think it's going back to education. It's going back to like why, the attractiveness of the industry. And, you know, let's not forget that the digital industry is growing, is intertwined in our lives. It is intrinsic in all of our lives. And whilst that industry continues to grow and help and facilitate and push in terms of innovation and progress, that only means that the threat level is continuing to increase.
You mean cyber threat level?
Yeah.
Confession. I'm 3/4 of the way through Zero Day, which is this new Netflix with Robert De Niro and other amazing actors and actresses. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely brilliant. So basically what happens is in the US, there's 1 minute where a cyber attack shuts down all mainframe systems, including all transport systems. Something like 30,000 people die in a minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously very Hollywoody. But the whole thing is about cyber threat. Mm-hmm. And it's just so, and it is so, as I've said, it's the hooded people in darkened basements being driven by unknown oligarchs from somewhere else in the world. And I wonder, you know, is that what it feels like at work?
No.
Boo! You're not superheroes yet.
I'm sorry. No.
It is part of how, I mean, it's been talked about every day now.
It is. Cyber. And I think there is definitely a lack of understanding about the threat level within our digital world. So from home security, nobody would think twice about putting locks on their doors, locking their windows, you know.
Don't come to my village. Nothing's locked. I can't now say what it is, can I?
No, don't. Get ransacked.
No.
But you know, securing your home.
Yeah, of course.
But what's the worst that can happen? You're going to get your telly nicked, maybe some photographs, things that can be replaced. If somebody nicks your digital security or nicks your digital identity, that's your bank account empty. That's you being held to ransom for whatever. You know, it could be life-changing and things that you could potentially never get back. And I think there's a lack of understanding that, you know, for 40 quid you could buy decent level digital security products. So I think there's that. And then
down to storytelling as well, though.
Very much so.
I've put into what I assume is quite a macho view of it. Yeah. And actually the story you've told is quite a softer view of it. Like you need to protect yourself. I'm on attack.
Yeah.
That's what I'm seeing. And you're on protect, which is quite interesting.
Very much protection first.
They appeal to different ears, aren't they? So there's a place for more storytelling from different voices. I don't just mean gendered there, but I mean race and heritage and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I think people are scared by technology. I think they enjoy all the trappings that technology comes with, but once you kind of, they don't want to break down under the first layer of it to understand how it all works, and therefore are therefore intimidated by the fact that they feel like they need to protect something that they don't quite understand.
Are you better at tech 3 years on? Oh, don't answer. Yes,
definitely. And then, you know, on the business side of things, I think, again, if you're a huge multinational or enterprise-sized organisation, you're going to have a CISO, you're going to be well looked after. But the majority of organisations, the cyber security falls on the IT guy or girl who's normally, you know, buying hardware, acting as the help desk, making sure the network's running, la, 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 where have I saved this? I can't find that. Oh, I'm restart. It's not happening. You know, all the general bombardment that the IT person gets. and then the bolt on is on, can you make sure that we're safe and secure and train all of our team to make sure that they're cyber aware?
Which is a bit ick, gives me the ick.
Yeah, you think that's a huge amount of responsibility for one or two. Exactly.
You know, there's a great analogy. I've been a governor of a secondary school for quite a long time, and the English department in all secondary, well, I think all secondary schools, definitely ours, for the kids coming up who can't read or write, have to teach reading and writing.
Yeah.
They're not trained to teach reading and writing. They're trained to teach literature or language, and it's a completely different skill set.
Yes.
Yet because books happen to be in front of them every day, and it seems like
very much the same. And at board level, I would say there's probably, again, a lack of understanding of the fallout of such an attack. There's the downtime. So if you are unfortunate enough to be the victim of a hack or a ransomware attack, then the downtime, how long is that going to be? Could be 24 hours, could be 48 hours, could be longer. That's your inability to trade. You know, what's the loss in terms of revenue? Then there's putting it right. So do we need to bring in third-party consultants? And do we need to rebuild things? What's the cost of that? And the time. So the time and the cost. Then the softer things like, what's the brand perception if you've just lost all of your customers' data? How willing are they going to be to interact or buy from you in the future? So we are marketeers. We all know that trying to change brand perception is way more expensive than trying to acquire new people in the first place. So, you know, what does that do in terms of convincing customers that to come back, you can be trusted, etc. So there's that. And then there's the whole cyber insurance agenda as well. You know, it's becoming increasingly difficult to get insurance that covers your digital security within an organization unless you've got certain products or services in place.
If you could, what would you tell your younger self about the power of being dangerous, big or little d?
That failure isn't catastrophic.
Yeah.
Failure actually is a good thing, and your growth will come from falling down, getting back up again. And also, the first time that things happen, they're scary. But once you've conquered them, that hurdle kind of done. Things are only scary the first time.
Do you think the attack that made you become a kickboxer, do you think that's made you less scared of things moving forward in life?
I think there's loads of things I've looked at. I thought, oh God, I can't do that. Or that's going to hurt. Or that's going to take weeks. Or I'm going to have to really throw, you know, everything I've got at this. Or often I don't know how to do this. And it's that, how do you eat an elephant, isn't it? Break it down a little bit. One foot in front of the other and just keep going. Just keep going.
And sometimes that's enough.
Yeah.
Sometimes just keeping going is enough. Sometimes you have to be greater than that.
Yeah.
Actually, sometimes that's great in and of itself.
So every year I have a marketing adventure with the team.
Okay, I want to come. They sound fun.
It's an annual. You say that now.
Okay, keep going.
Every year I have a marketing venture with the team. And the first year they came up to Yorkshire, they came to the house, to my house, and we had a barbecue, and it was all very lovely. And I thought, this is great, but this is really like pedestrian.
It's very cozy.
Yeah, cozy. Really, yeah,
nothing
yeah. Nothing
wrong with cozy.
How so? The mantra for team marketing adventure, the annual marketing adventure that fell out of that was, we are going to do something that is physically and mentally challenging and that we haven't all done together as a group. So the year after, we did the Three Peaks in Yorkshire.
Wow.
Which is three mountains in 12 hours.
I've done one.
Across.
Yes.
So it's a marathon. It's 24 miles in 12 hours with three ascents and descents. Much rumblings from the team. And I was like, look, what's the worst that can happen? It was really interesting to see how they all approached it differently. Some went training, some didn't. One of the girls in the team went and did a dry run of it. And we all turned up on the evening before and woke up very early the next morning and set off. And they were like, well, if we can't do it, Jules, I said, all we're going to do is put one foot in front of the other until we can't anymore. And let's see how far we can get. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant. And we lost some, you know, at various different points. Some of us made it all the way to the end. But as a team, it really built that camaraderie and that, you know, being outside, stripping everything away, no phones, you know, nobody with any makeup on, backpacks on. It was fantastic. And we still laugh about it now, the blisters, the loss of toenails. I'm sorry, Caitlin.
I hope it's you know,
yeah, I think so. We still laugh about it now. So, you know, but it was that mantra of, what if we can't do it? Well, what if we can? And if we don't, does it matter? Like, but we'll learn something from it.
There's the group challenge, but also what you've unlocked in that is the personal challenge. So if you've never done one peak and suddenly you've done one, then that's a big
tick. It's massive.
Yeah. Because they aren't easy.
No.
So
No. And then this year...
Yeah, I was going to say, what's next?
So that was 2 years ago. This time we climbed Snowdon, which sounded like a great idea. We've all done one mountain. Surely we can do... We've done three. Surely we can do one.
Much harder.
Well, yes, if it hadn't been pissing down from the heavens.
Okay, so.
It took us 9 hours to get up and down. Within an hour, we were all soaked through to the skin. The wind was horrendous. We all made it up. We all made it down.
Does everyone still like you?
Well,
We think so. Nobody's left.
But again, we laugh about it now. You know, it was dire. It was awful. But we laugh about it. It really brought us together as a team. No more mountains. Yes, I know, team. Spa day from here on in.
So have you announced the next one yet?
Yes, we are going on a yoga retreat.
Oh, fab.
Again, I think it'll push a lot of people, a lot of us out of our comfort zones in terms of the spirituality. Some of the things that we'll be asked to do will be uncomfortable because we're not used to being in that space. But I think physically it'll be challenging and mentally it'll be challenging. And none of us in the team have done it. So
amazing. Where are you doing that?
In Norfolk.
Oh, gorgeous.
Yeah, lovely. So that's the next one. Watch this space.
There's certain things in the workplace, and this is not anti-men in any way. It's just that for a long time, the workplace has been, for hundreds of years, the workplace has been dominated by men. So there's structures that are just being created by them, and we're still following. I think all of those things are open for question in a way that more than ever before. But there are things that I think are harder for women at work than they are for men. And I just wondered, things like asking for a pay rise, asking for promotion, sitting in a room full of men, sitting in a boardroom full of men, doing networking. Networking, a lot of people find horrendous. Do you find any of those difficult?
And no.
How, you don't find, oh, well, so let's go, why
I don't
why
know.
Not? Just
I don't
you,
know. I
perverse.
Think, never been frightened about asking for a pay rise, but always gone well prepared with why. And
so, Ken, this is down to your, so you're a, prepared Polly, aren't you? You like to be prepared. So what does that mean when you say you go in prepared? What do you mean?
So I go in, I'm not...
This is gold stuff, a lot of people. Yeah.
Not just going to waltz in and be like, hey, boss, can I have a pay rise because I've been here a long time and I deserve one.
And you're not, I'm great.
No, it's bollocks. So it's like, why do I deserve a pay rise? So, you know, and also, it's not something that I do all of the time, but I think there are key moments in either your career or the role that you're in at the time where you think, you know what? Done a great job there and I've stepped up and I've taken on more or I've done more or I've achieved more and I've never asked for a pay rise where I don't think that I deserve one. I think there's always been peace of mind that I'm doing the right thing rather than just money grabbing.
Yeah.
There's been a catalyst of this has happened and therefore I think, you know, over the last whatever period of time, that it's time for some recognition there. But I think always, to go in prepared of this is what I'm asking for and this is why I'm asking for it. And here is some evidence that backs up what I'm telling.
I agree. I think a lot of these situations, it's in the homework. And I think girls still probably need to do their homework quite a lot. So it's know your worth. Know what your top limit of your worth is. Know what the market thinks your worth is.
Very much so.
All those things. And then it's, as you said, also, and this is what I've done, tick, 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 to cross the line that you asked me to cross to get to the next stage. And that should be recognised.
And to walk into that room with confidence.
Yes.
Absolute clarity. And again, I go back to what I was saying earlier. Like, what's the worst that can happen? I'm going to say no. I'm no worse off than I was the moment that I walked through that door. I encourage it within the team. One of the girls in the team came and asked very recently for the same thing. And at the point in time, it wasn't something I could give to her. But the conversation I had was, I absolutely respect you for asking. Please don't let this put you off from That's asking good. In the future.
Yeah.
And this is something that you should be doing. And also, you know, what you'd put together in terms of a rationale was bang on, come back to me. I wasn't even back at my desk and she'd put an appointment in for 6 months' time to address the matter.
That.
I love that.
But you're also teaching people that it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay to ask, particularly in junior, more junior team members. Mm. It just smacks of ambition. And who doesn't want an ambitious team surrounding them?
Definitely.
So, yeah.
Definitely.
Because their ambition only makes you work harder, from in my experience. Mm. So, you know, they're pushing you. You're willing to be pushed forward.
Mm. So, no, pay rise is fine. I think being in a room full of men, I think, again, being brought up with boys, spending so much time in male-dominated environments outside of work, I've never felt like I wasn't an equal.
Yeah, brilliant.
Ever.
That's a gift, Jules. Lucky you. Because I don't think everybody feels like that. A lot of people come up with strategies to deal with it.
Mm.
Mine has definitely abated. It used to be a real, in my 20s, I hated it.
Oh, really?
I felt young and I don't know why. I think I'm very age aware, which is a weird peculiarity of me. But as I've got older, that has definitely worn off and it does not worry me nearly so much. But again, for me, I think it's like, I've now got all these years under my belt. I know this shit. So, I can stand shoulder to shoulder with people.
Mm. I grew up in a not over the very northern environment. I'm from Newcastle originally, so very, very northern parents. I never doubted, I never even crossed my mind that I wasn't loved. And they supported every decision that I made and were there to catch me when I fell down.
And mine never set any limits to my ambition.
Never.
Like, you can be an astronaut. I still think.
Yeah.
I'm 54. Yeah. One day I might be an astronaut. Do you know?
I want to be a fighter pilot.
We actually have to find a combat helicopter pilot on this series. But it's that again, that is a gift. That is a gift you're definitely given, isn't it? But it does ingrain that sort of sense of, doesn't matter what you want to be, we will support you to go and be that. Even if they're sitting in the back going, she's never going to be a helicopter.
And that line of, I don't care what you do as long as you're happy. Mm. There's something about my mother, which, I don't know, has hit me as I've got older. That woman was always content with what she had.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling of contentment, I think, is really underrated.
It goes back to our foundational moods almost, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Always content with the life she had, the environment that she had, me and my dad, whatever she was doing in terms of work, she was just happy and content. And, whenever anything was flashy that was put in front of her, she was like, I wouldn't swap my life for that.
Content. My mother's skill was so we've moved an awful lot, countries. So, different places, they've lived all over the world. And what her incredible skill was to make everywhere a home.
Mm.
Absolutely, so it felt like home even if when we didn't live there and it wasn't somewhere we'd ever visited, and to get this incredible community around her of friends and support network. And so, yes, and I definitely feel like I'm a community builder type person.
That's
definitely come from my mum.
Yeah.
We talked a bit up front about hybrid work. I've been able to leave my life because of hybrid working. I've been able to bring up children, work from home and come up to London, and just pivot my life around where I live and where my job was. And I wonder, I think I know the answer, but I wonder what you think. Do you think hybrid working is particularly beneficial to women? And does it enable women to go for new and different roles that maybe they couldn't in the past?
Definitely.
I think that's exciting, don't you?
Definitely. I couldn't have taken this role if it wasn't for hybrid working. I would have had to uproot my husband, who's got a great job in the North Sea or in the North, in Yorkshire, two kids. We just couldn't have done it. I couldn't have taken on that job. So that would have been a limiting or a barrier for me. The nice thing for me is when I go, I'm there for 3 days and...
I'm 100% present.
I'm 100% present. Yeah. 100%. And, I tend to go on a Monday morning. I come back Wednesday or Thursday. And one of the nights, I'll take one of the team out for dinner. So we do have like a one-on-one, go out, do something social together. Or as a team, we'll go bowling or we'll, do something. But I try and do something on an evening. And then when I'm there, I work. It's about balance, isn't it? It's about what you're going to give and what you're going to get back. So the reason I am allowed to work in the way that I do is that I give so much when I'm there.
So talk to me about your three dangerous mentors.
Okay.
I know you have a wide network, so we need to think of three. There's been loads of cheats in this section, so you can cheat if you want.
Okay. I was first inspired, I think, by a lady called Fiona Wilson, who was my boss in my first job. And I was like new to the world of work. I was just out of my master's. And she was feisty and ambitious and bold, and she swore and she smoked and
love her.
Yeah, love her. Yeah. And I just, you know, I remember looking, thinking, wow, like you are ballsy and successful, and just kind of opened my eyes, my view as to what it meant to be a woman at work. So I think she was a really big influence on me early on in my career,
very much so. Boss.
Then I worked for a lady called Liz Page at English Heritage, who we got off to a rough start, Liz and I. She was of an older generation. She was the ex-editor-in-chief of the Yorkshire Post.
So she's going to be a ball breaker.
She was a ball breaker.
Love
her. Yeah. But quite different in our approach to what work looked like. She was, you know, if you weren't in at 9 o'clock and at your desk, she's looking at the clock going like, where the fuck are you?
She's a bit clocker in.
Yeah. Whereas I'm like, hey, you know, it's, you know, we're in a new world, flexible working, and she'd do that. So her and I, it just took us a while to find our feet. Once we did, I mean, she was brilliant. She was absolutely fantastic. And whilst we disagreed on some things, like the ways of working and things, I really admired her ability and the way she conducted herself, which with such authority and confidence, and her ability to hold a room, and also the way she dealt with quite a lot of cantankerous men within that environment as well. She was brilliant. So really looked up to her. Hi, Liz. And then I'm going to twist on this one, and this is around a mentor, about not necessarily learning from, but learning how I didn't want to do things.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So working for an individual who quite difficult in terms of leadership style, inconsistent, didn't build trust, do as I say, not as I do. I learned a lot about the way that I wanted to be treated within the workplace, and also how I was going to treat my team by being on the receiving end of quite bad leadership and management, I think.
And was that a man or a woman?
It was a woman.
Thank you so much for talking to us. It's been brilliant. Tell us if people want to connect with you or find out more about you. What's the best way? Can they do that?
I'm on LinkedIn.
But you're not Julie. You're Jules on LinkedIn.
I'm Jules. Yeah, Jules Bereff on LinkedIn. Brilliant. Reach out, say hi. Always interested in speaking to interesting people. So
I can verify that. So yeah.
Thanks very much.
I loved that conversation with Jules. It just felt like we had so much in common, even if I've never been a kickboxer, obviously. Her leadership style, approach to team, and ability to fix what feels broken are all fantastically dangerous superpowers, and I hope you learned as much from her as I did. I want to thank you so much for listening. It means the world that you are joining our Dangerous Women community. And if you enjoyed what you heard, please do give us a thumbs up or subscribe to the podcast. And to find out a little bit more, follow us at the Dangerous Women Collective on LinkedIn.